is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And on this day in history, which, by the way, is always brought to us by the great folks at Hillsdale College, this day in history, Yogi Berra was born, one of the great baseball players of all time, perhaps the greatest catcher. And we had the good fortune to be able to record George Will's remarkable obituary for Yogi Berra. He passed away in September of 2015, and it was such a perfect piece, one that we had helped produce along with Mr. Will, that we figured we would run it on this day in history.
A high drive, that's trouble, and Yogi Berra, golf run, high over the screen and into Bedford Avenue.
It ain't over till it's over. 90% of this game is half another. When you come to the fork in the road, take it. It's deja vu all over again.
The 18-year-old U.S. Navy enlistee, thinking it sounded less boring than the dull training he was doing in 1944, volunteered for service on what he thought an officer had called rocket ships. Actually, they were small, slow, vulnerable boats used as launching pads for rockets to give close-in support for troops assaulting beaches. The service on those boats certainly was not boring. At dawn on June 6, 1944, that sailor was a few hundred yards off Omaha Beach. Lawrence Peter Berra, who died recently at 90, had a knack for being where the action was. When he stood as a catcher, he spent a lot of time crouching at baseball's most physically and mentally demanding position, 5'7". He confirmed the axiom that the beauty of baseball is that a player does not need to be 7 feet tall or 7 feet wide.
Berra swings, and that one's going to leave the ballpark. Well, what do you know? Larry Berra, they call him Yogi, his very first time at the plate in the major leagues against the A's. And what does he do? He hits a home run.
The shortstop during Yogi's first Yankee years was an even smaller Italian-American, 150-pound Phil Rizzuto, listed at a generous 5'6". Yogi had, as sports writer Alan Berra says in his book Yogi Berra, Eternal Yankee, the winningest career in the history of American sports.
Hall of Famer, catcher, Yogi Berra.
Played on Yankee teams that went to the World Series 14 times in 17 years. He won 10 World Series rings. No other player has more than 9. He won 3 MVP awards. Only Barry Bonds has more with 7, but 4 of them probably tainted by performance-enhancing drugs.
Ripped into right field. It's a one-run game as Bonds gets his second of the series. That's the furthest ball I've ever seen hit.
In 7 consecutive seasons, 1950 through 1956, Yogi finished in the top 4 in MVP voting. He grew up in what he and others called the Dago Hill section of St. Louis, when the Italian-Americans who lived there did not take offense at the name. They had bigger problems. Biographer Alan Berra notes that in an 1895 advertisement seeking labor to build a New York reservoir, the ad said whites would be paid $1.30 to $1.50 a day, colored workers $1.25 to $1.40, and Italians $1.15 to $1.25. The term WAP may have begun as an acronym for the phrase without papers, as many Italians were when they arrived at Ellis Island. American sports and ethnicity have been interestingly entangled. The name Fighting Irish was originally a disparagement by opponents of Notre Dame, which for many years had problems filling its football schedule because of anti-Catholic bigotry. But sports also have been solvents of a sense of apartness felt by ethnic groups. In 1923, the Sporting News, which for many decades was described as the Bible of baseball, except by baseball fans who described the Bible as the Sporting News of religion, called the national pastime the essence of the nation. Quote, In a democratic, Catholic, real American game like baseball, there has been no distinction raised except tacit understanding that a player of Ethiopian descent is ineligible. The Mick, the Sheeny, the Wop, the Dutch and the Chink, the Cuban, the Indian, the Jap, or the so-called Anglo-Saxon, his nationality is never a matter of moment if he can pitch, hit, or field. Ah, diversity. In 1908, the Sporting News said this about a Giants rookie, Charlie Buck Herzog. Quote, "The long-nosed rooters are crazy whenever young Herzog does anything noteworthy. Cries of Herzog, Herzog, good boy, Herzog, go up regularly. And there would be no let up even if a million ham sandwiches suddenly fell among these believers in percentages and bargains." David Moranis, in his biography of the Pirates' Roberto Clemente, the first Puerto Rican superstar, notes that as late as 1971, Clemente's 17th season, one sports writer still quoted him in phonetic English. Quote, "If I have my good arm, the ball gets there a little quicker." In 1962, Alvin Dark, manager of the San Francisco Giants, banned the speaking of Spanish in the clubhouse. Today, with three of the most common surnames in baseball being Martinez, Rodriguez, and Gonzalez, some managers speak Spanish. Yogi's great contemporary, the Dodgers catcher Roy Campanella, another three-time MVP, was the son of an African-American mother and Italian-American father. Today, with two Italian-Americans on the Supreme Court, it is difficult to imagine how delighted Italian-Americans were with their first national celebrity, the elegant center fielder on baseball's most glamorous team, Joe DiMaggio, the son of a San Francisco fisherman. DiMaggio was Big Dago to his teammates. Yogi was Little Dago and became the nation's most beloved sports figure. As Yogi said when Catholic Dublin elected a Jewish mayor, only in America.
This is Lee Habib on This Day in History. Yogi Berra was born, as always, brought to us by Hillsdale College. And if you can't get to Hillsdale, Hillsdale comes to you with their great online courses at hillsdale.edu. And thank you, George Will, for that superb reading. And this is Our American Stories. And all this month, we're focusing on foster care stories because it is National Foster Care Month. And this story is brought to us today by Children's Rights, an advocacy group for children without many or any folks advocating for them, children who are abused or neglected in the foster care system. You can learn more about their important work at childrensrights.org. The story they brought us is by Dylan McIntosh. Before hearing from Dylan, I want to read a little bit about his story. His biological parents were heavy drug users and alcoholics. One time his father told him, quote, "I'm going to hit you so hard you won't be able to sit down tomorrow." He then beat him with a wooden sword. Dylan was 3 years old. He went to school the next day and told the teacher he wasn't allowed to sit down. That incident led him to his first foray into the foster care system. Let's now hear from Dylan.
You're 5 years old. You're lying flat on your stomach at the top of the stairs, listening to your social worker tell your foster mom that you have to go to another foster home. This always scares you and makes you wish you were a normal kid. Most of what happens doesn't faze you, but what does matter is that you're going to have to meet a new family, get to know a new family, be a part of a new family. That's always the hardest part, adjusting to their standards, their norms. You hear the creak of the steps as your social worker climbs the stairs to break the news to you. You always listen when your social worker comes. Her name is Miss Goldie. You're not even sure if that's her real name. It just seems to sound nice and go along with her hair, a shade of gold. She's always been kind to you. breaking the news in the most caring way possible. She'd always say something like, "We're going on a trip. You're going to meet a new family. They're going to love you. And you're going to be able to watch whatever you want on television, not just Blue's Clues. It's time to get going. Get your things together, sweetie." Children aren't supposed to feel this way. They're not supposed to wonder where they'll be in a day, a week, a month, or even a year. You put everything you own in a black trash bag. What lies ahead, you have no way of knowing. You just have to brace for it and hope for the best. You put your black trash bag in the trunk of your social worker's car. You sit in the back seat and you fasten your seatbelt. On that day, you don't meet a new family. You're left behind at the county agency. The building is cold, industrial even, but you're a kid and you don't notice those things. Your black trash bag is set down and your social worker buys you a bag of chips. You're left to sit on a bench alone. After an hour, a sheriff's deputy comes to get you. He doesn't even know your name. He's tasked with making sure you have a place to stay that night. He picks up your trash bag and takes you to his office. You're fortunate enough to get a sleeping bag and a space by his desk. Hope is what you need in every situation. Whatever you have to deal with, just deal with it. One way or another, you're going to get through it.
And folks, even though Dylan would be tossed around to 23 different foster homes, aging out without being adopted, Dylan had hope, and he would become part of the only 3% of foster children to graduate from college, and that is a stunning number. Dylan's now working and has a dream of starting a nonprofit that helps foster care children aging out of the system. I have no doubt he'll get there. And listening to him, you can't even imagine. You cannot imagine. And from the very sad but inspiring to the pathetic. We've been bringing you some great commencement speeches, and we told you we would, and we're going to continue to. Robert De Niro's is just terrific. Go to OurAmericanNetwork.org. Take a listen. What words of wisdom he had for the Tisch School of Arts at NYU last year. And today, well, Duke graduates were bored to death over the 2015 commencement speech by physician and anthropologist Dr. Paul Farmer. And that's what we're doing today, folks. We told you we'd bring you some bad ones. And this one, well, this is number one on Google search. In this 38-minute speech before the entire student body and faculty, Dr. Farmer rambles on and on while occasionally stopping to criticize the audience for not laughing. Actually, probably like one of his daily lectures. While we won't torture you with the entire speech, you might prefer to be waterboarded rather than hearing what we're about to play for you today. Warning, and this is on my script, do not listen to this speech while driving or operating heavy machinery. So let's take a listen. Dr. Farmer started out with a joke about how he thought he was in trouble when the president of Duke University, Richard Broadhead, called him to ask him if he would give the commencement speech.
Broadhead's subtext seemed to be, "After all Duke has done for you, what have you done for Duke?" That was supposed to be funny. You know, how come it starts raining when I get up?
Oh, he's off to a slow start. You think he can pick it up? Well, Dr. Farmer goes on to joke about how he missed the call from the university president and had to call him back.
Conspiracy theories picked up speed along with my pulse. When my prompt response, I called Broadhead, like 2 seconds later, led to more anxiety. His assistant, who I knew well, refused to tell me a thing. "Oh, I'm not at all sure what this is about," she said darkly, suggesting I call him at home that night. It had to be that I was the worst trustee in Duke's history, reaching back into the 19th century before the Bassett affair. I wondered if anyone would laugh at that, and the answer is no, only a trustee, one.
Oof.
This generation doesn't do history.
Oh, that's what you do. When you're in a hole, you don't just stop digging. You don't insult the audience. Well, in what was perhaps the liveliest portion of this excruciating speech, Dr. Farmer gets to the point in his conversation where he was asked to do the commencement speech by the school president.
Now, I said none of this to our dear Dumbledore Gandalf when he and not his wife picked up the phone and asked if I'd give the 2015 commencement speech. Hell yeah, I almost said. Been hoping you've been asked that before Coach K came to dominate. Yo. Done did Yale and Harvard frickin' medical school. 10 years back. Instead, with faux gravitas, to mix unnecessarily highbrow but broad-headian terms, I replied, thank you, Dick. It would be my great honor to do so.
Ooh, this is getting rough. Dr. Farmer tries to make another joke that goes flat. God only knows what point he was trying to make here.
Anthro undergrads, PhDs. Duke faculty get over the culture wars yet? The 19th century ones? That was an informed joke and fell flat.
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
Well, more God knows what from Dr. Farmer.
Take home messages must number 3, 7, or 9 and be grounded in narrative. I have only 3, and though I don't trust TED Talks any further than I could throw Jahlil Okafor, I would not have fried and sunburnt you if we were in Wallace Rose Bowl Wade PTSD Stadium.
This is brutal.
Oh my gosh.
Not getting much love from the crowd, Dr. Farmer tries to find some common ground by talking about sports.
How about that big win, 68-63? I was in Sierra Leone the day Duke beat Wisconsin. And maybe forgiven for believing that March Madness was a term recently invented to describe the stuttering decline of the Ebola epidemic.
Oh my goodness. Wah-wah. And who cares if you were in Sierra Leone? Farmer goes on to try another joke about Ebola that falls so flat, he blames the audience for not getting it.
Kudos to our honorary degree recipient, Dr. Harold Mooney, the plant man, and a Duke grad who shaped the field of modern ecology. Now stop Ebola. Another informed joke wasted on all of you.
Oh my goodness, I can't even
apology, forest, bat, never mind.
Oh my goodness. We have to stop. We can't do this to our audience. They love us too much. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. And you know, folks, we promise we'd bring you great commencement addresses. And, well, this is a great one too in its own way. And hopefully it goes viral eventually as the worst commencement speech that we've found so far. And we're going to continue to look for you so you don't have to. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories.
Kudos to our honorary degree recipient, Dr. Harold Mooney, the plant man, and a Duke grad who shaped the field of modern ecology. Now stop Ebola. Another informed joke wasted on all of you.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard.
I can't believe that was a commencement speech at Duke. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And now it's time for our weekly Marriage on the Mind segment with Deb Walniak. Last week, Deb brought us a powerful interview with two women, Cindy Snyder-Ray and Pam Paquette, who both have chronic illnesses, as do some of their children. This week, we wanted to do a follow-up interview with Cindy's husband, Tony, and his very different experience with chronic illness as a family member who doesn't have it, and how to be supportive when he doesn't know how it feels, and often he can't even know through his bride's facial expressions whether she's in pain. And I know this personally. My wife suffers from chronic pain, and I know that millions of others do. And Deb, thanks so much for joining us and bringing this to our attention.
Thanks for having me.
You know, last week you brought us the really powerful interview with two women, and that was with Cindy and Pam and their chronic illnesses. And this week we go to a conversation with Tony Ray and Cindy at the very end of the conversation. And this is, Deb, this is a superb piece, and let's take a listen together.
Do you have other guys that come up to you and go, how are you handling this?
For me, as I was working and knowing what was going on at home, I really didn't have a clue. And, you know, I was the provider. I did my thing, and I got my identity for my job, and that's where I got, you know, that's where my success was. And there was a lot of things going on at home that I just didn't have a clue. And it's the one thing that has been very interesting is, and it's been a journey, is as I've been home and I see what they're going through, there's times when they look fine. And I think, okay, you look okay. So what's going on? And they don't always have the words to describe what's going on either, but I've questioned it a lot of times myself, and I live here with them and I see it, but it's like, you seem okay. So on the outside, Cindy could be having a great day, and inside she's learned to live with the pain and to kind of mask it. And so trying to describe that to people is very, very challenging and difficult at times.
It's hard because I'm also trying to step into your world, and we just can't even imagine the level of physical pain, the level of financial challenge, and then the efforts you both are putting in to your marriage and trying to stay connected. I guess that sense of normalcy is something that you both strive for, but with also an eye to reality. Is that right? Am I catching that?
Yeah, you said it very well. I mean, it's trying to, I mean, you got to grasp at the fact that things have changed, and the life you used to have is not there anymore. And certain things are taken away, and, you know, the people you love most, you see the pain and anguish on them, and it's now trying to get to a new normal. And I've made this comment to people before about, you know, we're doing better. We've kind of arrived at a new normal as a family. And when I say that, it's like it's an ongoing journey. It never becomes normal. It's just a different way of doing life together. And it's a big change. Mm-hmm. But the fact that we're in it together is probably the biggest blessing.
Mm. And that is a big thing, because so many of us, well, of course, we all age and we get into our senior years, and we then discover chronic pain sometimes in our later years. And we feel like people can't relate to us. All of a sudden, yes, there's that grief and loss piece that you have to kind of go through in this letting go process. Do you think people need to be afraid of that?
Well, I don't. Boy, that's a great question. I don't know that they need to be afraid of it, but because it's part of what life is. And I think Cindy and I definitely have gotten to the point where we're starting to look at the illness and the pain and the struggles and the mess that it is, and seeing that, you know, glimpses of that's where God does his best work. And it's our faith that keeps us kind of moving forward. And sometimes we take a step backwards, but understanding that has been a big blessing. And I think it's, for us, it's kept us continuing to move forward. So there will be fear from people who maybe aren't on this journey yet, or they're just entering it. The fear is going to be there. And even for us, it's, you know, it's out there, but we've learned to, because we've been at it for a while, to manage it, and manage it through our faith and together.
So I'm going to challenge both of you on something, and whoever wants to go first is fine. Let the other person know either how much you appreciate them, or give them a compliment. Something after all this journey, from the time that you were at the altar through all these different chapters and ups and downs and pain, give the other person either a compliment or something that you appreciate about them.
I can go first. I have appreciated and been blessed by Tony's strength and integrity through all of these years, for the level of commitment that he has made, not only to me, but to our family. He is a good man, probably the best man that I have ever met, and the one that I love most in this world. I cannot imagine having gone through this or being on this journey without him.
Well, so mine would be the thing I most appreciate about Cindy is just her perseverance as she's gone through this. I still marvel at the level of pain that she has, and she continues to just move forward, and she's been an example to me. And for 20-some years, it's been about me and my job, and I didn't see that for many years. And now that I do and I look back on it, I look at this beautiful woman and think, and thank you. And I thank her for her being patient with me, because she was carrying a lot of the load. And now it's my turn. And this ministry is just a huge blessing. And to see her and Pamela do this is just, I mean, it's beautiful. And I see her light up now because she's able to do something to help others and be part of it. And all the help that she's done in the family, now she can, you know, she can do that for other people, and I can be part of it.
And that is just, well, that's too much to hear. It's so powerful. And, you know, Deb, that's kind of, I mean, it's almost bringing me to tears, her describing her husband and then him describing her. And you wish people would do this more in public and more often for one another. But talk about that, Deb, and just how it moves you to keep going. It's got to really be inspirational at some point, listening to people like this, Deb.
It is, it is. You know how sometimes you look at a beautiful piece of artwork and you have to, like, look into the depth of it, and you see the strength of the colors, and then as you continue to look, you see various different tones of, let's say, a color green that you didn't see before. So much of marriage is like that. So many times when we start out our marriage, we're like, okay, you know, we're on our honeymoon, we're doing awesome, we're hanging in there, we're building for a future, and you're totally nesting and you're doing everything right. And one of those days, sometimes either the lull sets in or the tragedy, that explosive stage of something that you don't even expect to happen, and it does. These are couples, like we just heard, that have gone through the depths of frustration, not only financially, but physically, with an ailment that will never leave them. And yet they have this inner strength that blows my mind. And I see what they have worked on over many years. And they stuck together throughout. And even in this retirement stage that they're currently at, and believe me, retirement for them is not slowing down. It's continually serving the children that they have that need continual medical support. This, to them, is their life's mission, and they want to continue to serve and help others. This is the most amazing thing about love, and true love, is it not only sees the other person for who they are, but they continue to encourage and strengthen and build the other person up so that other people around them say, I want that.
You bet.
And how did you get through that? I want to know what they're doing.
Yeah, and I want to be that. In the end, I want to be that. I mean, you lead in the end by example. We know this always. And my goodness, these kids are lucky. That's all I can tell you. This is Lee Habib, Marriage on the Mind with Deb Wolniak. Chronic illness, chronic pain, how it affects marriages. More with Deb after these messages.
I cannot imagine having gone through this or being on this journey without him.
I look at this beautiful woman and think, and thank you. And I thank her for her being patient with me.
And you're listening to Cindy Snyder-Ray and her husband, Tony. Cindy's stricken with chronic pain and chronic illness. Tony, just working, going about his life, and not really appreciating what his wife had gone through. It had effects on the marriage. Of course, anyone who's lived with chronic pain, a mate, a spouse, knows, a mother. You know, we're going to be doing a segment on Bernie Marcus. His mother suffered from intense arthritic pain, and it's lived with Bernie his whole life. In fact, you go to Atlanta, you'll hear about the Shepherd Pain Center. And Bernie will tell anyone he met that half of what fueled his desire to be able to earn the money he earned was to be able to at least take care of other moms and not have the children see the mom in chronic pain. So very personal for me as well. Know a lot of people who suffer from this. And Deb, thanks so much for doing this, really. And let's talk a little bit about how this has affected you, Deb. And we, you know, we're always talking about other people, but you know, you're facing people in tough consequences and circumstances almost all the time. And that is that people don't generally seek marriage help. And obviously you're a coach, you're not a counselor, so you're not waiting for the crisis. But you live through a lot of crises, Deb. One of my best friends is a pastor in town, and I always see the stress and the burden that being such a leader, an emotional leader and a spiritual leader, takes, what the toll it takes. Talk about just you for a second. And I don't, not that I want to make you the spotlight of this, but it just interests me on a personal level, Deb. The toll it takes on you and what you do for sustenance as you try to be a strength and a resource for so many couples who seek your guidance.
That is a great question. Sometimes I move so quickly I don't like pay attention to myself, and be brutally honest with you. And it's been a three-year journey already. And recently I took a vacation to not vacation. Does that make any sense?
It does.
I literally had no plans. I told my husband, this is, I don't need to go anywhere. I just need to stop, because I've been moving for 3 years and carrying a lot of the burdens that people bring to us, and trying to direct them, network, get them to better spots, get them into our mentoring program. And I haven't stopped. And I literally found myself in the garden one day, just, okay, I'm just going to work on this. And suddenly just started bawling. I mean, it came out of nowhere.
Yep.
And I'm like, what is going on? But I have to listen to my heart. I have to listen to my spirit. And that was that outlet. I've been carrying that burden for so long. It was time to let that go and just be free. And it was a great moment. I so appreciate that. That happened in a couple different waves. And that's totally normal for people who deal with jobs that have that level of stress. I mean, I think of medical, police, fire, even our military folks that are on, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the mom or dads that are working the home front while their spouse or significant other is deployed. These are all heavy burdens that we're bearing. And even I let people know that one thing I took away from that is I got to give myself some space, not 3 years from now, but on a regular basis, even if it's doing a breathing technique for 15 minutes where I shut off the phone, shut the door, and just breathe. That is going to be important for longevity. Same thing with relationships. How then, in your current situation, are you applying some of the techniques that are going to make you stronger as a couple, stronger as an individual, in order to continue serving, especially those with long-term disabilities or chronic pain?
You bet. And how does this affect your marriage, Deb? I mean, I know, again, the pastor friend of mine, I have another who runs a big detective squad in New York City, and it never stops for him. And right. I've watched good friends, you know, as serving others, almost lose themselves and their own marriage. And boy, there's it would be nothing worse than a marriage coach ultimately having marriage problems. But look, you're not immune to reality and real life. Just talk about that, Deb.
Absolutely, 100%. I'm an open book. If anyone wants to ask me any questions about this, I'll pretty much tell them like it is. My husband works for a group called InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. They're an interdenominational group on campuses around the world, and he helps manage 52 different college campuses. His travel schedule is pretty intense, and of course, in his case, he is in a ministry. And so what does that do? That takes coordination and family schedule. We operate a little bit like a military family because we know someone's always at the home front. We have children 15 and 17 years old. Everybody knows who has teenagers. That's like the thick of it. You got to be present for those teenagers and to be able to work through issues that come up. It could come up today at, you know, an hour from now, and I won't even expect it. So one of the things we have is a flexible schedule, which we're very thankful for. And we have teams around us that know that we need some of that flexibility. So we always manage a schedule at home, et cetera. But what comes down to is not just a business decision. It has to be also, we support each other in each other's roles. And we also have to stop and see how we're doing. how are you doing? I'm feeling pressure on this end. I'm working on the finances. We haven't talked about this. Let's stop and talk. So to make those very specific, purposeful appointments where we're engaging on home business and then with each other, those date nights are so critical. And I will tell you, Cindy and Tony have those, even with the heavy medical schedule that they've been carrying. If you can do a date night or a date time, even for 30 minutes, I know it sounds crazy. It may be in the morning for some of those that are coming off a third shift. It may be for lunch. It may be after the children go to bed, but you need to have a face-to-face conversation, eyeball to eyeball, even knee-to-knee holding hands and looking at each other and just saying, I had a tough day, but I just want you to know I love you. I had a tough day too, but I love you too. But can we talk about this? Get that conversation going. And even the little that you invest in, even the 15 to 30 minutes, will not come back void. It will come back with fruit. If there's something that you have, parking lot topic, you know, like it's so big that we may not be able to solve it in one night, let's write it down on a piece of paper, put it up on the fridge or maybe in a special book that we read, or maybe if you're of faith, a Bible or some scripture that you look at, just put it in there and keep that topic at the forefront, because you do need to come after that and follow through. Otherwise, guess what happens? Things build up, the pressure cooker goes off, and all of a sudden we're in an explosion phase, and no one wants that. We want to be able to try to piecemeal this through, because life happens. It happens. The question is, are you awake and are you working on it day to day with your spouse as a team, not against each other, but as a team? And that takes time, study, communication, and love, because there's sometimes when a spouse can't be present. And it's, you know what, if it's because of chronic pain or a medical issue like we've heard, you know, that's a season, that's a time, and sometimes it's a lifetime. But in this case, these are really good examples of how you can make a purposeful decision to be present in the pain in order to serve, and that love will continue to grow. Keep looking at the other person and say, what is the best spouse I can be for that person?
Indeed,
Deb. Loving on them.
Indeed. Yep. And what are we looking at next? What are you looking at for the next week or two? Where I think we've hit the pain thing well. What are we looking at down the road here with you, Deb?
You know what? I ran into a gentleman here that is amazing. He is a young professional. He's an entrepreneur, has had much success in the business world, even working with sound and an organization called Pixar, of all places. Mm-hmm. And he is the quintessential millennial male, African-American, and has a very good argument of why not to be married. And what was great in that conversation, and I said, would you be willing to share this with a broader audience? And why am I saying that? Because if you flip the coin over and look at why people are saying not to get married, is part of the reason in the healing and the path toward why you should get married. So I'm going to throw that out as a little bit of a challenge. And if you're game, we're going to record that very soon, and we can bring that to an open forum.
I would love that. And as you know, we're both connected to a project right now that we can't get into deep detail with, but it has a lot to do with a test pilot in a couple of major markets in this country on trying to look at why and how we can get more people to get married younger, having kids. Too many young people, as we know, Deb, are just saying no to marriage because of what they view as the burdens of marriage or what they've seen before in their own lives. And so they want to run away from it because they didn't experience anything pleasant on the marriage front. And I look forward to being able to discuss that with you as well. Deb Wolniak, as always, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Lee.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And, you know, listening to that line of that wife telling the husband, he is a good man, the best man I've ever met. And I think every guy wants to have his wife say that about him. And then what he said about her, her perseverance, I marvel at how she continues to move forward. And my goodness, he thanked her for the patience she afforded him because he hadn't really paid attention. And boy, that's, I think, a lot of us men not paying attention to things that matter, caught up in our work. This is Leigh Habib. This is Our American Stories. As always, Marriage on the Mind with Deb Walniak. And you can call 844-627-8255. If there's a subject that's on your mind, something you want us to cover, you have a story about chronic pain, leave it there. 844-627-8255. And this is Our American Stories, and it's our This Day in History time, and we're going to spend an hour on this person who, you know, well, let's put it this way, you know the brand he created, you may not know him. And as always, this is brought to you by Hillsdale College, the great folks there. And we don't just do political figures. We've done Alexander Hamilton and Winston Churchill and Margaret Thatcher. And we do sports figures. We just did Yogi Berra. We did Johnny Carson. We're doing Frank Sinatra. We love business leaders. We've done Ray Kroc, Truett Cathy, J.P. Morgan, and Sam Walton and Andy Grove. And today, well, you're about to hear one heck of a story.
What do you say, guys?
Let's do it!
I'm gonna run, make a run to the hardware store. I need a new screen for my old screen door. Washers and screws and nails by the pound. You can't find it there, can't be found. If it ain't in store, they can order it. Square peg, round hole, they'll make it fit. Whatever you need and a whole lot more. They got it all over at the hardware store.
In a time not too far away, if you wanted to fix your house, you might not have. You might not have because you didn't know how to do it. And you might not have because you couldn't afford to pay someone who did. Even if you did, or your contractor did, it would first require going to the paint store, then the hardware store, then the plumbing supply store, then the lighting store, and then the lumber yard. When the car runs were over, the weekend was practically over. That project? Left unfinished. But that was all before June 22nd, 1979. The day everything changed. A day that was made possible by two words uttered just 1 year before.
You're fired!
Never let fear of failure or the potential of a setback paralyze you from decisions you'll have to make. If Bernie and I hadn't been fired, which I would label as a setback, we might not have started the Home Depot.
This is the story of Home Depot. And this is the story of its co-founder, Bernie Marcus.
Now, they call me a philanthropist, but the truth is I'm just really giving back. I'm giving back to this great country, which really gave me the opportunity to achieve the success that I've had. I've had a great life. Now, how did I get there? How did I get to the point where I'm a check writer? Did my family have money? No. Did I inherit money? No. Giving money away is a long way from how I began my life. Mine truly is the story of America and the reality of living the American dream.
It's a story that starts in Russia. A story that starts out in desperation. Bernie later wrote, "In desperation, they picked up and left the only life they and generations before them had ever known."
Being Jewish, they were just, pillared, and it was not a safe place, and there was no future for them. And their entire family left, and they were able to get out. They would probably not be alive today. I wouldn't be alive today if they had stayed back in Russia, for sure.
Thankfully, they didn't.
I'm a first-generation American who started my life in a fourth-floor, walk-up tenement in Newark, New Jersey. My mother and father were Russian immigrants. They came to America with no money. They didn't read, write, or speak English. They came with nothing. They had nothing. But to them, that tenement was a paradise, a penthouse compared to what they had in Russia. My mother believed that America was the golden land, and wherever you put your mind to, you could achieve.
The tenement was so bad they tore it down to build a slum, Bernie now jokes. It was the only home I knew, of course, and I loved it.
I decided at a very early age of what I was going to be when I grow up. We were poor, and no one else in my family had a college education. But at the age of 12, I knew that I was going to be a doctor. That was my dream. By 13, I had studied all of the medical books in my doctor's office, and I knew the anatomy of the body. By 15, I was doing my own diagnosis when I went to the doctor. And by the way, I was more right than he was most of the time. After high school, I started my pre-med studies, and I was a pretty good student. In fact, I was so good that I qualified and I was accepted to Harvard Medical School. But because of quotas, and in those days, there were quotas for Jewish students, and it was 10% in medical school. I couldn't get in unless I donated $10,000 to the school. What a joke. We certainly couldn't afford that. If you took my entire family and you held them upside down, you couldn't raise $10,000. So medical school was out. I was discouraged, disheartened. My dreams were shattered. Frankly, for a time I gave up.
Bernie quit school and he hitchhiked down to Florida.
How did I get from there to selling hammers? And that's a pretty long story, but it's interesting because when you think you know where your career will take you, it can turn out totally different. I know doctors who are real estate developers. I know real estate developers who are running medical companies. While you may be convinced there's only one way to fulfill a dream, you're going to find out there are many roads that lead you to your dreams. And those dreams may find you when and where you least expect it.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, the life of Bernie Marcus, born on this day in history, co-founder of the Home Depot. More after these messages, this compelling life story. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. In this day in history, Bernie Marcus was born, and we're celebrating his life, the co-founder of Home Depot. And we left off, he'd faced quotas at Harvard. And by the way, we did a segment a few weeks ago in which we learned that Asians are now facing those very same quotas that Jews faced at Harvard. But let's now go back to Mr. Marcus's story.
Bernie didn't expect himself to be in the home improvement industry as the CEO of Handy Dan. But there he was, eating lunch every day with a colleague named Arthur Blank and working for a boss named Sandy Segaloff. Here's their top public investor at the time, Ken Langone, on what he thought about old Sandy.
Father, you got to pray for me because this is a man I will never, he's dead now, but I will never forget him, okay? He was a really cruel, cruel human being. That's a tough thing to say, but it's true. He had on his desk, he proudly had on his desk a sign that said, Ming the Merciless.
Well, Ming hated how Bernie had made the company successful.
Hated me, I hated him.
And he hated how Ken the Catholic and Bernie the Jew had become close.
He's a devout Catholic who swears like a sailor.
Ming was breathing down Bernie's neck about the threat Ken posed to his power. And so Bernie decided to do something about it.
And Bernie came to me one day and said he wanted me to sell the stock back to Sigeloff. Sigeloff didn't like me and I didn't like him. But I knew as long as I owned 19 or controlled 19% of the company, he wouldn't mess around with Bernie. Bernie persuaded me to sell the stock, and I said, Bernie, I'm signing your death warrant. He said, no. He says, he needs me. He needs me. I said, Bernie, I'm sorry. You're a dead man walking if I sell the stock. Anyway, he persuaded me to sell the stock at a huge premium because he wanted it. And 3 months later, on a Saturday afternoon, I was traveling, and I got home late Saturday afternoon with my son. My then 14-year-old middle son said, some guy's been calling you from California. He's been calling you 6 or 7 times today. And I said, you leave a number? He said, yeah. So I called him up. It was Bernie. And I said, Bernie, you got fired. Is it in the papers yet? I said, no, but I understand you called here 6 or 7 times. He said he fired me, he fired Arthur, he fired Ron Brill.
And then, at the age of 49, how? I was fired. Fired. That had never happened to me before. I was 49 years old. I had a family, had obligations, and all of a sudden, my world came to an end. For the second time in my life, with what was a career-ending experience.
Bernie and Arthur were middle-aged men out of work, but it was wonderful, as Ken bizarrely told them.
It was one of the happiest days of my life. My immediate reaction was that, Bernie, you just got hit in the ass with a golden horseshoe, and you don't know it.
So I thought the man was demented. I thought there was something wrong with him.
And he said, what are you talking about? And I'm saying, let's go into business. Let's start a company. And he was, I'm out of a job. Are you nuts? I've got no money, and you want to start a company?
Bernie was so fearful that someone else would steal his vision that he never even told Ken what it was.
And he said, tell me about it. And I said, no, I'm not telling you about it because then you'll know about it. I said, the only person that knows about it is here, in here, and I'm not going to share with you.
He was that paranoid about it. I don't know what the hell you're talking about, but let's do it. Because if it's that good and it's that dangerous, let it be ours.
Bernie finally shared his vision with Ken. It was time. Their time. Bernie's, Arthur's, and Ken's. Together.
1978, if you looked at it, the homeowner, typically if he wanted to do something in his house, he would have to get go to a plumbing store, an electrical store, a lumber store, a hardware store, and so on. And prices were pretty high. And so typically if something had to be done in the house, they would have to get a professional to do it, which means a plumber, electrician, everything else. It was our concept that if we could have a store big enough to incorporate all of those things, hardware, lumber, electrical, at prices that were significantly lower. And I'm talking about a third lower, one third lower. Mm-hmm. And then if we hired professional people like carpenters, like plumbers, like electricians, mm-hmm. and teach homeowners how to do it themselves, that we could help America and grow a great business.
The first guy they tried to get on board to finance their vision was Ken's friend, Ross Perot. And Bernie showed up to the meeting in an old Cadillac, not thinking anything of it.
He said something peculiar. He said, well, our people don't drive Cadillacs. I said, well, what do you want me to do with this car? And he said, Bernie, our people don't drive Cadillacs. And I said, wait a second, Ross. Yeah, I don't want to spend money on a new car. We have this old car. And he said, Bernie, our people don't drive Cadillacs. Well, the third time is all I needed.
I just finished with Sandy Segaloff. I wasn't interested in being manipulated or controlled by anybody.
Bernie later wrote, if Perot hadn't been so hung up on Cadillacs, his original 70% share of the Home Depot stock would be worth approximately $58 billion today. Langone would secure $2 million from his group of New York investors, and they were off to the races.
No rest for the wicked and a hard-working Georgia man.
Bernie and Arthur settled on Atlanta as the home of their operations.
We all moved here. We knew nobody. And we had no family, no support group. All we had was each other.
They settled on Pat Farah as their chief merchant. They settled on an opening day and on their ad in the big Atlanta newspaper that would announce their opening.
They didn't run it. The newspaper never ran it. It was like the worst thing that could have happened to you. Here you put all your money in, and the clock is ticking, and the money is going out, and you're paying people.
The day we opened up, we expected to see thousands of people. I mean, we were convinced that we were going to win the Super Bowl.
Our promotion was, come to the store, we'll give you the first dollar. And we're handing out dollar bills.
And we threw this great party, and, you know, nobody came. I mean, we just couldn't figure it out.
7 o'clock that night, we were still handing out the original dollar bills. Nobody had come. We were all broke, not just myself. Arthur was broke. Pat was broke. We were all living on the edge, and this was the most important day of our life. We didn't have much money in the bank. We had great difficulty buying product because most of the people didn't want to sell us. The balance sheet was slim, to say the least.
The image wasn't right, so we figured, well, what's, you know, how do we fill it up?
Farah's answer, fake it for now.
I contacted one of our suppliers and said, how many empty boxes do you have? They provided us about 3,000 boxes, just empty boxes. And we put them all together, put them up in the overheads to make it look like we were just so jam-packed. It was just unbelievable.
We had a stack of, I don't know, 2,000 paint cans stacked up way up high in the ceiling. Out of the 2,000, I think maybe 300 were filled with paint. The rest were all empty.
But we had to give the cans back.
So they needed more cash. And so Ken found them a venture capitalist who was interested. Here's Arthur Blank.
We had a deal with an investor from Boston, and he came down and he spent time with us, and Bernie drove him to the airport. There was a line of questioning having to do with our growth and our strategy and his involvement and things along that line, and Bernie got very uncomfortable with all of it.
The investor asked all of them to get rid of their company cars, take a 10% pay cut, and the last straw for Bernie? They'd have to pay for their own health insurance.
And Bernie has a temper and has got a lot of principle and believes strongly in ourselves and what we're doing. And his way of showing that was that if you want to step out of the car and we're going 50 miles an hour, you're welcome to do that.
It got worse. Staring down a third edition of Ming the Merciless in his life, Bernie yelled,
get out of the damn car. You are a stupid son of a. You can walk to the airport for all I care.
Bernie then got out of the car, and as the man timidly got out, Bernie tossed his luggage by the side of the road.
Please don't leave me here,
the man pleaded. After several minutes, Bernie relented and allowed him back in. The guys went on and got their funding, and most of all, they got people in the door.
And this is a great story that just keeps getting better. The life of Bernie Mark is celebrated on this day in history. Bernie was born, and we've celebrated Truett Cathy's life, Sam Walton's, Andy Groves, who recently passed, the founder of Intel. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. More on the life of Bernie Marcus after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we continue now with our This Day in History segment, celebrating the life of Bernie Marcus, co-founder of Home Depot, born on this day in history. And as always, this segment is brought to us by Hillsdale College, the best place in America to learn about our nation's history, the Constitution, great literature, all the things that matter in life. And if you can't get to Hillsdale, Hillsdale will come to you with their terrific and free online courses at hillsdale.edu. And before we pick up on the produce piece, I want to just share a little reading from Built to Scratch. Bernie was writing about the early days at Home Depot in this book, which covers the life of Home Depot. Quote, "We had a singular vision that we sold over and over again. The first group we sold it to was the bankers. The second was the vendors. We used to tell people that we would lead our industry before long and be convincing when we said it, too. We dared them to look into our eyes when we said, 'Do you think anything is going to stop us?' You must stick to a vision and turn people into believers. We had to be psychologists, lovers, romancers, and con artists to get them on board." And now let's return to this riveting life story.
Guys went on and got their funding. And most of all, they got people in the door. One day, Bernie asked one of those people where she was from. And she said Athens. New to the area, Bernie had no idea where it was.
I said, "Oh, Athens." I said, "That must be very close by, is that?" And she said, "You stupid boy." She said, "I drove 2 hours to get here to this store." And I said, "2 hours? Why did you come here?" And she said, "Well, her cousin had called her. And the reason her cousin had come, because somebody else had called her cousin." At that point, I knew that this was a winner. There was no question in my mind about it.
And so they doubled down. They opened more stores.
Marietta, now it's your turn to see what Atlanta's been talking about. The Home Depot. Atlanta now, Marietta, you've never seen anything like it.
Their model was working. But something much deeper was at work. The culture they created was at work.
We generated a fever, and we attracted people that were entrepreneurial. And when it's all said and done, these people didn't want to go home.
In one of those early days, Bernie told associate Lynn Martineau, "I didn't hire you to do, because you are going to have to do anyway. I hired you to think."
Bernie was the cheerleader and the inspiration. And the employees just cheered and felt that they were working for the best team in corporate America.
The core of their culture is something one of Bernie's golfing buddies was convinced would take them out of business. He was prepared to spend $200 on a new faucet. And a Home Depot associate, who he called stupid, showed him how to fix his old one for $1.50. A lost sale in his book, and he wouldn't tell Bernie who it was, thinking they'd get fired. And then Bernie shocked him when he said,
"How about if I give you a written guarantee that they won't be fired? How about if I tell you I'm probably going to give that person a raise?"
"Why?"
"Because that person did exactly what we want them to do. We are there to save money for consumers, not to sell them products they don't need. And you know what? You're not the smartest guy in the world, but if you ever had something go wrong with your household plumbing again, where would you go?"
"Right to that person."
"You just proved my point. You just proved how good our people are. The key is not to make the sale. The key is to cultivate the customer."
People who will spend 25 to 30 minutes explaining a $3 sale. Now, where do you find that?
So how did Bernie and Arthur create Home Depot's culture? You just can't make it by proclaiming it. They first did it by spending 25 to 30% of their time in the stores.
We never went with an entourage. We put on our orange aprons. We walked every aisle. We always dealt with customers ourselves. We dealt with the floor associates ourselves. We always asked them questions about the business. What are we doing well? More importantly, how can we improve? What are the customers asking for that we're not giving them assortment-wise? Is there any issue on pricing, any issue on different suppliers? I mean, we would probe a lot with them, and that gave them a sense that, you know, we're really important. We really count. We really matter. We're closest to the customers.
And Bernie and Arthur both personally spoke at every single training session for managers.
We wanted them to hear it from us and hear it consistently from us in the same sort of language.
Investors couldn't believe that after they had quote-unquote made it, with almost $30 billion in sales at that point, that they both were still speaking at every one of those training sessions. But Bernie said they had to. They have to hear it from our mouths. We're the they. When people say this is what they believe. And it made all of the difference. Almost all came to believe it and internalize it too. As the author of the book, A War for Talent, showed.
You know, he was about six companies that they profiled. I was the last person that he interviewed in our company. He interviewed about 100 of our associates, anywhere from cashiers to lot engineers, store managers, merchants, etc., United States and Canada. And he came in and he said, every place we went, we asked about the culture, we kept hearing the same things. Now, the words were a little bit different, but the essence was exactly the same. He said, somehow the beauty of this company, no matter where you go, United States, Canada, East, West, North, South, is that people express the same philosophy. Well, a lot of that, I think, came out of us doing the hands-on training, continuing to articulate the same values and same culture over and over and over again, and by only promoting people that actually believed in it and lived it and understood what our culture meant.
And I want to read to you about a couple of other ways Bernie and Arthur created that culture at the Home Depot. First, about why they don't have aisle numbers at the Home Depot, the only retailer with 100,000 square foot stores on the face of the planet that doesn't have them. And built to scratch, Bernie wrote, quote, "If I ever saw an associate point toward a customer what he or she needed three aisles over, I would threaten to bite that associate's finger. I would say, don't you ever let me see you point. You take that customer by the hand and you bring them right where they need to be and you help them." It was also a culture that they ingrained at the corporate office. In fact, they refused to even call it a corporate office. I had never heard of a company refusing to call it a corporate office before. Home Depot called it the store support center, so everyone at headquarters knew what their real focus was, not on the vendors or on the investors, but on the individual stores. It was always, always about the culture and staying close to the customer. Home Depot took this emphasis on the stores even further. Every employee at the store support center couldn't start there. They had to start somewhere else. Bernie wrote, quote, "We insist that every executive of this company works in the stores upon joining us. This policy even applies to our attorneys. When we hired Larry Smith as our first in-house attorney, we said, quote, before you assume your regular duties with us, you will be in the stores for 2 months. He didn't believe it. Are you crazy? He said, I'm a lawyer. Well, if you're going to be handling lawsuits, you're going to have to understand the problems of people in the stores, we told him. And to do that, you have to work in the stores so that when you hear a problem, you can actually relate to it. He did, and ever since, Smith has insisted that all of his new attorneys and paralegals also work in those stores. And when we come back, the final segment in the life of Bernie Marcus. This hour is always brought to us by Hillsdale College. And we'll get into the philanthropic giving of Bernie Marcus, as is so often the case with great American businessmen and so many Americans, our capacity to give. And this story of the 1%, Mr. Marcus started with nothing, built up something remarkable, brought down prices, delivered a great service to the American people, and at the end, gave most of it away. And this story happens again and again. This is the story of the 1%, started in the 99%, became the 1%, and was generous with his wealth. This story you don't hear at most American colleges, but you will hear it over and over again here on Our American Stories. More after these messages. Thank you. This is Lee Habib in the closing segment of an hour-long celebration of the life of Bernie Marcus, co-founder of Home Depot. We were just talking during the break, and I had mentioned that my mom took those courses. It wasn't just that Home Depot was a great store for men. My mom took those courses for women, and she, along with my two brothers, rebuilt our entire basement. Brick, carpentry, the whole nine yards, and that's because of Home Depot's remarkable focus and vision on the customer and the customer satisfaction. And some people would have said, what a waste of money. Not Marcus, Blank, and Langone. And now the rest of this story.
There will always be some folks who just don't want to take care of the customer. So Home Depot brought on a guy named Ben Hill, who always would.
The name Ben Hill just came from, we were driving around 285, which is one of the highways that circle Atlanta, and we needed to come up with a name for a customer service call-in number, and we just saw an exit called Ben Hill, so we used that name, and it felt like a something would be a kind of Atlanta-based.
At the front of every store, Ben Hill asks, are you satisfied? If not, call me, Ben Hill. Now, Ben Hill wasn't a real person, but there was a real person picking up that phone line. Actually, it was three people.
The three people that would respond to the calls are myself and Bernie and Pat Farah.
Bernie wrote in Built to Scratch. It didn't matter if we were signing a $1 million deal. We stopped and took the call.
And we told the folks running the stores, the store managers and the assistant managers, that we would be taking all those calls. So to them, they said, well, the last thing we want to do is get, you know, a customer calling in, speaking to myself or Bernie or Pat, you know, and we would give the customer whatever they wanted because that was, you know, that was our culture, that was our mentality, that was our approach to, you know, to great service. And then call the store manager and say, why does this customer end up having to call us? You could have satisfied him in the store. Well, that decision had a lot to do with building the initial culture in our company because what happened was that the folks running the stores, I mean, they got together with all the associates in their store, and they said, look, we don't want to get any phone calls from Bernie and Arthur or Pat, and, you know, so we're going to satisfy every single customer that comes into this store. We want no Ben Hill calls. So they actually started to track them. And so the associates in the stores would do whatever they had to do to make sure the customer walked out with a smile on their face, which is really the culture of our company. We wanted them to react and act as though it was their names on the stores and not the Home Depot.
An associate named Larry Mercer took this culture to such an extreme that he once gave a customer a refund on tires he swore he bought at Home Depot, even though they didn't sell tires. Sure, some customers would come do that to you, but the vast majority would come to trust you, a value you couldn't put a price on. Lowe's emerged as Home Depot's first real competitor. And take a listen to Bernie's reaction.
I think that it was very important for Home Depot for Lowe's to come along. I think that it was at a moment in time when we were very self-satisfied with ourselves.
And yet they'd never match Home Depot. Here's Arthur Blank sharing what Bob Tillman, the former CEO of Lowe's, told him.
We studied your company, you know, in such an exhaustive way. He said we traveled all over the United States, Canada. We had stores in Chile at that time, in Mexico, and he said, you know, we went in, we probably spoke to 200 of your associates, you know, and every place we went, we found that the associates believed in this unique customer service, and we copied your stores, we copied the size, we copied the pricing, we copied the vendor selection, we copied the signing, we copied everything we could copy. He said, the one thing that we could never copy, we could never understand how you were able to do it, was this culture, this unique culture you had of selling and putting the customer on top, taking care of the customer no matter what it took, et cetera, that we could not understand how that was done.
One of the most important ways it is done is by taking care of the associates who are on the front lines with the customers. They got there because they were given and deserved greater opportunity.
When I left the company, we had 150 offices. Two-thirds of the offices never finished college.
And they got there because they were given an opportunity to participate in profit sharing, to grow as they helped grow the company. But it's not just about money. It's also about fulfillment, something Home Depot has offered to folks often forgotten. including with the so-called Bernie Boys and Girls.
We gave those senior citizens, if you will, who in many cases were very familiar with do-it-yourself, didn't want to work 40 hours a week, wanted to work 20 hours a week. Their spouse didn't want them home for lunch every day, and they wanted to interact with customers, and they knew the product, and they had a smiley face, and et cetera. So we brought a lot of those folks in on a part-time basis. And they were great. They were great with our customers. They were great role models for our associates, for our younger associates. So we looked for ways to give people who could, you know, who believed in us, ways to grow within our company.
In 1997, Bernie visited the store in Boynton Beach, Florida, and an older man started hugging him. "You changed my life," he said. "I am the happiest person in the world." "That's terrific," Bernie responded. "You don't understand," the man said. "You hired me 5 years ago, when I was 70. Nobody else would hire me." Then he said, "Let me introduce you to some of my coworkers." And he brought over a whole cadre of guys and one woman who were all in their 70s. In fact, one guy was in his 80s.
Along with my partner, Arthur Blank, we created the Home Depot, which today has more than 2,200 stores, sales of over $80 billion, and employs more than 300,000 people. Remember, this happened because of our free enterprise system, where in fact you can create Home Depots. You can be successful. I was.
This has had a bigger impact on the economy than 10,000 legislators in Washington.
But Bernie believes it couldn't have happened today.
If the same thing happened today, the Home Depot would open with 4 stores and maybe we'd have 8. How sad is that? So what's happening to America?
Here's Bernie sharing just one example.
Litigation has killed off America. We figured out at the Home Depot that when you bought a tool, any tool in our store, I don't care if it is a saw, a drill, whatever it is, approximately 25% of the cost of that product was a deterrent at litigation. It was built in. It's insurance because they know they're going to get sued. Take a hammer, a stupid hammer. You know how many times the Home Depot has been sued because people drop the hammer on their toes? You wouldn't believe it. You wouldn't believe it. Idiot drops a thing on his toe, and he sues us first.
But the story isn't over for America. Bernie's fighting back with the Job Creators Network.
We need to have 10,000 business people in every single state of the union who now speak out the same way, who get on air and say, "You want to know something? That piece of legislation is garbage. And you know what? They lied to you. That is a lie on what they're going to do, because I know the effects of that on my business. I will not be able to hire people. I will have to fire people. I will have to let people go. I am not going to expand because you've taken away my ability to raise capital." I mean, they can go out there and speak the truth and say, "I run a business here." Go attack a guy who owns 3 restaurants. He'll poison you the next time you eat there.
And the story isn't over for his wealth.
He wants to give his money away, he says, before he dies. And a lot of people don't think that. They want to pass on vast wealth to their children. Well, his children are fine, and they're fine people, too.
Bernie never forgot his responsibility.
I'm Jewish. We have a word called tzedakah. We grow up with it, and it means that you have to give back. It's part of our religion. It's part of who we are. You find Jewish philanthropists. You know, in the United States, we represent 1.5% of the population and 18% of the philanthropy. No other country would have allowed me to succeed if I had born in Russia or Poland, where my parents came from. This could never happen to me. So those of you who take this world lightly, you should not.
His partner, Arthur Blank, doesn't take lightly what Bernie has meant to him.
When I say that I love Bernie as my partner, I love him more as my brother and as my partner. I love him as my partner, too, and he'll be my life partner. But, you know, Bernie is a mixture of a brother to me in some ways a father too. He's 14 years my senior, and I lost my dad when I was only 15 years old. So it's been a life partnership as opposed to just a business partnership, and for that I'm forever grateful.
And what a life story. And by the way, Bernie and his bride, Billy, gave $250 million to build the most magnificent aquarium on the face of the planet, the Georgia Aquarium. And note that it's not the Marcus Aquarium. He could have given it his own name, but he named it the Georgia Aquarium in honor of all of the people of Georgia that made his story and that made Home Depot's story possible. And it revitalized a blighted part of the city of Atlanta. And by the way, Bernie learned about giving from his mom. They didn't have much, but even then, she was always there to teach the kids. No matter how little you had, you always had the obligation to give and to serve others. And that servant's heart serves us all today. The life of Bernie Marcus here in Our American Stories, this day in history, born.